words of Danny Dyer, have you got your trotters up? Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the Thinking Time Wasters Pop Culture Talk Fest. My name is Andrew Harrison, and this week, as England bask in World Cup euphoria and Scotland, Wales and Ireland bask in World Cup despair, we're down in the Big Mouth bunker helping everybody to avoid the football. Joining me as ever, it's Sean Patton and the level-headed Peter Taylor to my ill-disciplined Brian Clough. Hello, Sean, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Have you been successfully avoiding football this week?
No, I've been successfully non-avoiding it. I've been watching it.
Have you been throwing yourself into it and painting your face?
Totally, yes. My face still is covered with flags, isn't it? Yeah. Mm. No, I've been enjoying it, especially the penalties.
Yes.
Very good, very good.
They should just do the whole thing on penalties and it'd be a lot quicker.
Get that much better game, yeah. Three-sided football, I like.
Three-sided football?
That's actually a thing, yeah.
But you have to make allegiances.
Situationist, yeah. It's a different way of playing it.
Anarcho-syndicalist
people go
football.
And play it, yes.
Mm. Also with us, as well as Sean, we have two special guests. First up, she's a broadcaster and columnist. She's best known as a presenter and interviewer on The Word with Terry Christian et al. Back in the 90s. She came to Britain as a dancer and appeared in both Michael Clarke's I Am Curious Orange with Music by The Fall and the Pet Shop Boys Performance Tour, where she appeared as various schoolboys, go-go dancers and, if I remember correctly, a piglet. Did you have to wear the piglet mask, Casey?
A whole piglet fat suit.
Fantastic.
Yes, and we sniffed Neil Tennant's bottom and made PU gestures.
It is, as you hear, Katie Puckerick, who now presents radio and her olfactory YouTube series, Katie Puckerick Smells. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're glad to have you here. So what news on the smells front? What have you been discovering lately on the olfactory beat?
Well, there's a perfume. I'm actually wearing it today, so perhaps we can all be enjoying it in the fug of the smell in the bunker, which is reminiscent of a daytime pub, rather dank and a little stanky. But I'm wearing a smell by Byredo called 1996, which to me smells like sexy carrots.
Sexy carrots?
Yes. It's supposed to be leather and patchouli, but to me it just definitely has kind of a... sweet and...
A root vegetable.
Insinuating root vegetable.
It's very nice, actually. I did smell it.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks, Sean.
Katie routinely tweets smell facts to her followers. One of this week's smell facts was that the longtime signature scent of Keith Richards is a blast of Joy by Patou in his armpits. Joy is a thick fog of jammy roses, stanky jasmine and critter hindquarters. Have you actually personally ever smelled Keith Richards?
I haven't smelled Keith Richards, but I wear Joy upon occasion. I actually spray it into my bath water because it's one of those things that it's like instantly filthy. So you need to be washing yourself at the same time that you're experiencing it. But I haven't gotten within olfactory distance of Keith.
Who's the most interesting pop star you've smelled? You just discussed Neil Tennant's bum there, which is always interesting.
Yes. Well, we're going to split some hairs here because I don't know how interesting a pop star he is, but I have smelled him. Mm-hmm. And that is Jim Kerr from Simple Minds.
Oh, really?
And he's quite the fume head and connoisseur of fine fragrances.
Oh, really?
And I interviewed him a couple years back, and I was enthusing about his woody kind of forest floor mystique, and he eagerly brought me to around the back of his limo and opened his carry-on bag and showed me what he was wearing.
There's a wealth of euphemisms in there that you described. What has been your favorite smell fact you've discovered so far?
My favorite smell fact has to be the fact that during the Cold War, the East German secret police, the Stasi, collected smell files on all of their enemies. So anybody that they considered enemies of the state or revolutionaries or just general troublemakers to be, they would invite them in for a little Q&A time. And as they were making their victim sweat on the seat, they had a little smell pad secreted underneath the bum area. And so then they would save that little bit of fabric in a jar. And the idea being that in future, if anybody acted up, they could send the sniffer dogs after them because they knew what they smelled like. So basically now they still have in the Stasi Museum in Berlin, they have rows and rows and rows of shelves covered with these jars filled with people's smell.
A definite reason to visit Berlin, I'm sure you'll agree. Sean, we have another guest today, do we not?
We certainly do. He's the contributing editor to Mixmag, the wisdom of Acid House Raving. He consults with DJs and pop stars the world over to decide who ought to be remixing whose records. And over the past few years, he's hooked Tensnake up with Nile Rodgers and Puff Daddy up with Israeli DJ Guy Gerber, which is quite an odd mix. He is Ralph Moore. Hello, Ralph. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. That's a great introduction.
I am just startled
by
all those
that.
Names. Especially Puff Daddy. Did you go and see the Pet Shop Boys performance tour and spot Katie doing her thing in the day?
I think I was a bit too young to be coming up to London at that point, right. But I was a fan and I am a fan. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I do remixes for the Pet Shop Boys now. So best one we did was got Carl Craig to remix Inner Sanctum, which they loved so much that they sold it as a special bespoke 12-inch at the shows. So,
and what do they smell like, the Pet Shop Boys? Go on. You gotta remember.
I haven't got that close.
The Pet Shop Boys actually did a smell record. They did a smell over the single Miracles, mentions the scent of jasmine in the air. They put it out as a promo and it smelled of jasmine. It was lovely.
I didn't know that. That's beautiful, so interesting.
Beautiful jasmine. Wow. Smell. Very nice.
That's all right. That was a good smell fact.
Smell fact.
Yes. Do DJs buy a lot on scented candles? Because we know where they like their luxuries and their, this and that and the other. And they into smelly,
I'm not sure if it's on brand for DJs to be talking about candles. I think the ones at the top of the tree definitely like great, smells for the planes or the private jets or whatever. But I've never had a conversation with a DJ about a candle.
They love spending. They've got to find something to spend all these billions on, haven't they? They do love their
luxury.
They've
got to complain about something afterwards on Twitter, haven't they, as well?
Moaning about they can't get the
Weirdly, the saddest one I saw, slightly going off-piste, was Tiësto did an interview, and he admitted that he spent so much time at shows and on planes that he didn't actually have a home. And it's bizarre, isn't it? It's like, that's not normally the first thing you do when you make some money is you go, right, I'm going to
Isn't that what Willie Nelson does? He just has a tour bus and recording studio, and that's pretty much it.
See, I'm an avid follower of DJs complaining on Twitter, which is just DJs complaining about flights, usually.
It's generally about flights, isn't it?
Yeah. So they obviously do spend a lot of time.
Or complaining about the size of the mint on the pillow. Look at this mint, it's crap. Call this 5-star. I'm going to, jump off the Burj Khalifa, that kind of thing.
Enough of this. What's on the show, Andrew?
Well, I'm glad you asked me, Sean. This week we've got not one but two rockumentary experiences for you. BBC Four have just run a Duran Duran night, and the programmes are still available on iPlayer, of course. What did we learn from Duran Duran, There's Something You Should Know, and the subsequent Influences show on BBC Four? Are the warring Durans at peace, and is BBC Four running out of people to call iconic? Meanwhile, the John Lydon biopic, The Public Image is Rotten, is currently touring cinemas. Will we learn more of the infamous post-punk butter salesman? Plus, Marvel Comics relaunches Captain America, with the great African-American columnist and commentator Ta-Nehisi Coates scripting it. Are we going to get a woke Captain America, and are we ready for it? And finally, it being summer, we're going to find out the ultimate summer music and ultimate beach reading from our guests. All that and more after this important message from Sean.
Why not do a good deed this summer and help us pay our studio bills by supporting us via the crowdfunding platform Patreon? We're asking loyal listeners for the equivalent of a pint of beer at the price occasioned by the current carbon dioxide shortage. That's a mere £5 a month. Pledge us this modest amount, and once we reach our target of £600 a month, we'll start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. The link is also at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page too. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Okay, it's time for Tinker, Taylor, a.k.a. Duran Duran Night on BBC Four. The slot usually given over to shows like At Home with B.A. Robertson or Mandolin Britannia or that footage of a hippie buying a guardsman's jacket in Granny Takes a Trip yet again. Gave itself over to pop for once with two documentaries on the self-styled chic meets the Sex Pistols of the Midlands. What did we think? We're going to see after this. It is, frankly, the only Duran Duran song I can tolerate. This is Notorious.
The Nick Rhodes rise with you. That was Duran Duran with Notorious. BBC Four just gave us Duran Duran Night with not one but two documentaries. Although the evening seemed to go on for hours because there's all this other footage. Duran Duran sitting in an old Citroen that they used as a tour bus. Deeply glamorous. Visiting Anthony Price to talk about their stage gear. Back of a warehouse, first auditions, blah, blah, Influences show, David Lynch, Top of the Pops. You get the idea. Katie, Were you a Durrani, or could you not wait for the specific hell to be over?
Well, I lived in Washington, D.C. at the time, or just outside in the suburbs. And so me and my little new wave buddies would make the pilgrimage in several times a week to the 930 Club in downtown D.C., where we saw everyone from Psychedelic First, Simple Minds, Bauhaus, Nico, Nina Hagen. And so in the slightly bigger club, which was the Bayou, that's where I saw Duran Duran and U2. And all of those bands were exotic. So we didn't make any differentiation between, oh, this is teenage pap or this is deeply cool and insider. It was all just really amazing new music that we didn't have access to in America. So I didn't make a distinction about that. And in fact, I remember chatting up John Taylor very shyly outside the club where they just played to about 100 people in 1981. And he was very blown away by the fact that there was a parking meter because he felt that that was deeply glamorous and American. So I like them. I love that kind of happy, sappy, pappy, dancey new wave music. And so I didn't have a problem with them. And in fact, I felt like Duran Duran were emblematic of everything that was exciting and cool and aspirational in pop music in the UK. And when I moved here in 1984, I actually lived in a tiny little bedsit right around the corner from EMI. And a couple times a week, there would be the thundering of chubby-thighed teenage girls as they chased after the Duran Duran limo that would circle around from Manchester Square. So that was very much... Duran Duran, to me, seem like everything that is kind of exciting and pop music and now about the UK. So I was happy to revisit them.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of the program as putting this band into context? Often, you know, they're seen as very pop here. They're not seen really as new wave. And them desperately sort of trying to validate themselves. Do you think that worked?
Well, judging from the use of the word desperately, I can see that you're not convinced. But they definitely popified the whole new romantic thing. And their influences, like the show about their influences, which were just like everyone who liked pop culture in the 70s and 80s would have picked all those same things, like Blade Runner and Eraserhead and, you know, all the
Bowie
others.
Bowie and Chic and all your favorites.
Yeah.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
I think that was good. It was very comforting and nostalgic. So I didn't feel like they were deep thinkers necessarily, but I enjoyed hanging out with them on the sofa going along for the ride. And certainly the documentary about how they came up in the world, I thought... I liked them as a group. Mm-hmm. They seem like they've come to terms with, they're adults now. They've matured. And I always love those stories. And you've seen it in the Eagles documentary and also the Metallica documentary, where the groups get off their high horse and they're humbled by failure. And it makes them a more rounded, likable individual or individuals in this case. So I enjoyed it. It wasn't eye-popping television. They're not, you know, hugely deep, but they're nice guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ralph, you told me earlier that you were a bit of a Durrani.
I am. I mean, I'm a big synth pop electronic music fan, so I could talk for days about this. I'm not going to, but I'll try and condense it down. My two favourite sort of pop acts who are duos are the Pet Shop Boys and Tears for Fears. Mm-hmm. Pet Shop Boys get on like a house on fire. They work together. They create and they collaborate and they enjoy hanging out. Tears for Fears, not so much. They work together because Roland writes the songs and Kurt sings Everybody Wants to Rule the World and Mad World, but kind of don't really get on, and they certainly don't hang out or smile or talk too much when they're not in the studio. There's no magic in that. The magic of Duran Duran is that even though one of them has left, the four who remain do still get on. They look pretty good. They had hits in the 80s and the 90s. They're very, very proud of Ordinary World. But that album, actually, the Wedding album was a pretty good pop record. And then they came back with Pressure Off with Janelle Monáe and Nile Rodgers, and they kind of felt contemporary-ish again. Mm. Not pretending it was a huge hit. It wasn't. But it made the point that Notorious made, which was, we're not just girls on film, that band on a boat.
That's one thing that was really... I mean, you know, cards on the table, I can't stand them. I've always hated the music. I've always thought it was a load of... It was the most annoying aspect of 80s pop, where it's just about achievement. There's nothing in there. It's kind of hollow. It's the, you know, the opposite of ABC or the Human League or
what do you
soft
mean
sound.
The opposite of achievement? Those are well-crafted pop songs.
No, sorry. It's just about being big. It's just about being big. There's nothing within the music the way there is in ABC or the Human League. It was all they wanted to do was be big. So I've never been able to really enjoy the music. But watching the show, I actually quite liked them. They clearly know they've kind of got away with something incredible and brilliant. By the sweat of their brow, they pulled something off.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I felt a bit bad for kind of begrudging that over the years, because clearly, you know, you see they come up from suburban Birmingham where there isn't, you know, this isn't the Hard Knock Life. This is just the ordinary boring suburban streets that we've all come from. But they decided to reinvent themselves and it worked. So I found myself a little bit guilty for hating Duran Duran for all these years.
But you can't knock them for being popular, though. I mean, they're popular because people like them.
Absolutely. But what I was knocking is that the entire, you look at an ABC or a soft sell, there's content to it. There's something to it. They've got something they want to say.
Yes.
And Duran Duran never wanted to say anything at all. They just wanted to be big.
They're in a different genre.
Yeah, I know. And that's probably me being
You could also say that ABC really wrote some wonderful songs, but they weren't like trying to change
the
world.
They're not the miners either.
The interesting thing about Duran Duran, and I'll try and sort of keep this short, is that if you talk about Simple Minds, if you talk about an awful lot of 80s acts, if you talk about Spandau Ballet, they would all look at Duran Duran and go, they've kind of done a better job than us, because Spandau Ballet don't have their singer. Yeah. They now have a new singer who's some guy who's literally 29, who could be half the age of the band, and it's just silly. Even if you're a fan of the band and you'll stick by them, no one wants the lead singer to be replaced. It doesn't matter. Like, you have an entire lifetime of loyalty to that band and that singer. It doesn't matter. It's not necessarily about Spandau. And then who was the other one that I just mentioned? Simple Minds. Simple Minds tried to go credible in the way that we desperately want some other acts to get credible and bring that back. Because Duran Duran aren't so hung up on that, they've kind of had the best career of all of them, which is why they get this...
They're consistent, and also they were there in the coming of age of a lot of kids in the 80s.
Yeah, I think that works wonders, doesn't it? If you're there at the right time in the stage of a person's life, then they'll be with you forever.
I mean, the final thing on this, because we probably all could talk about it all day. Although they're men in their 50s, they look good. They look good. Like they, you know, like some people, you want pop stars that you grew up with, just in the way that Brian Ferry still looks great in his 60s. You want him to carry himself. Like Nick Rhodes, bless him, doesn't look quite as young as he did 15 years ago, but he still looks like Nick Rhodes.
He's making the effort. I have a quick question, though. Why do they all call Simon Le Bon Charlie?
I think, yeah, it's their nickname for him.
I wonder why that would be. I have no idea.
I did a few features on Duran Duran and interviewing them piece by piece and trying to do the thing. One for you, I believe, Harrison, a million years ago. Trying to do that, almost we get to the real bit of the story, and there's lots of stuff that I think they've BBC-ified this programme, in that there's masses of drug stuff, the stuff about the models, also interesting, the drum capsizing, Simon's boat, all that stuff. There were some big things that happened to them. The narrative is actually quite bumpy, and I would have quite liked to see that.
If you want to criticise it, there wasn't much for me that there wasn't much that I didn't know.
Someone like
it doesn't
Ralph,
reveal,
yeah.
does it?
So where was Warren Cuccarillo? Where was this? Yeah. Where was
Where's
the strange
Stephen Tytal Duffy?
Stephen Tytal Duffy. Yeah. Where was that strange period between sort of 1996 and about 2003 or something?
There's no
where,
power station stuff in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, where there's this weird hybrid of sort of work experience members of Duran Duran you've never heard of.
It needed an extra hour. If they'd done less, here's our David Lynch film from a couple of years back.
Oh, that was so unwatchable. Did you guys even try to
watch that? I tried.
I did a fast forward, and the best thing by far was Beth Ditto coming on, and that actually made you go, oh, here's a real singer. And it made me like Notorious, because she sang Notorious.
Now, why do you not like Notorious?
Oh, because it's just, it really emphasizes the worst aspect of Simon Le Bon's singing, which is he's very whiny and nasal. I was shocked to find out that he was a quite a credible choir boy.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that
beautiful
was
beautiful voice of an angel.
But,
pointing to it.
Voice of an angel. But it's just things like Wild Boys, Notorious, like really clunky, awkward, bad white guy funk. I just don't like. I like the more Save a Prayer, Ordinary World, The Chauffeur, the kind of like cod Roxy music, melodic balladry.
I mean, that you just nailed three of the best there, definitely. I mean, it's interesting because, like, I'm with you, and Andrew will never ever agree on this ever, which is quite funny.
One thing about this, though, I found this. Though it was quite endearing, and I felt, like I say, I felt bad about sort of, you know, frowning at Duran Duran all these years, but it is unintentionally a very, very funny film. As they're talking about, you know, I think one of their collaborators pops up at one point and says, well, the great thing about Duran Duran is that they've always been ahead of the crowd, and they've always been relevant, and they've never been frightened to lead. And I thought, that is so wrong. They were playing catch up for decades. And there's nothing wrong with playing catch up if you're trying to stay on board. But the documentary, as Sean says, it is BBC-ified to the extent that everything had to be legendary. You've got this strange,
iconic
and legendary, and comparing yourself to the Beatles. And I just thought, no, look, be happy with what you've got. You've pulled off something that nobody can pull off. Don't also tell yourself you've got to be Andy Warhol and the Beatles at the same time.
The punk rock references were manifold as well.
And it was telling that there were an awful lot of albums that they just sort of skipped over.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Where was the gigantic section on their notoriously dreadful covers album?
Well, quite.
Where they did White Lines Don't Do It, which was produced the greatest headline ever in the NME. 021 is a joke. Because they covered 911 as a joke. Anyway. Shall we move on for another rockumentary?
Bless them, though.
Bless them.
Just
I mean, no hard
them.
Feelings. They're, you know, good luck to you, as my dad used to say. Good luck to you. Anyway, more rockumentaries. The Public Image is Rotten is the new John Lydon biopic presently doing the rounds. And if you go to thepublicimageisrotten.com, you can find out where it's on near you. The Sex Pistols story has been done to death, but how much do we need to know about John Lydon's post-Pistols afterlife? Here's a taster of the film.
We were completely thrown in at the deep end right from the start. There's not very much fun being in a band like that. Having to deal with a management was more into the sensationalism aspect of the thing. I wanted immediately to start a new band, and one that would approach it without that media mockery attached. So I used the term Public Image Limited. We started rehearsing and the songs just flowed.
The way that record starts out really changed the landscape.
It was like a diagram of how to write a song.
We were quite a wild band. There was always a huge undercurrent of danger.
You know, when push comes to shove, you shove back.
The media wanted to bury me. I had to really, really fight for my survival.
Metal Box, it changed my life.
It's one of my favorite albums ever made.
When I left, I said to someone, I'm going to leave.
I'm going to be leaving.
I'm leaving the band.
The list was damn well endless.
So this is what kicked everything off again. The success of that song was what, you know, Virgin had wanted all that time, remember, a hit record.
Because up to that point, I hadn't considered that people actually really respected me inside the music world itself.
John gets up and he starts singing. There's a kind of wind that he creates. And you just sort of pop, put your sail up and...
Hello! Are we ready, boys? Hello! Hello!
Ever get the feeling you've been curated? A bit of The Public Image is Rotten there, the new biopic of John Lydon, currently touring cinemas around the country. Katie, did you ever encounter John Lydon on your travels in pop?
Yes. He was a guest on The Word.
Must have been fun.
Circa 1993, I think it was. Mm. And he was holding forth, is how I'll put it, charitably. Towards the end of the program, it was a live broadcast. We were desperately trying to end the show and conclude the proceedings. And so I had the producer yelling in my earpiece, make him stop talking, make him stop talking, because he was on a rant. And so I just kind of did a I just went physical. I went physical theater on his ass and just kind of did a body block on him. We were all on this little podium in the middle of this baying mass of audience, this Roman circus that was The Word every Friday night. And so I just kind of tackled him, and he shoved me away from him, and he kept ranting. I basically pinged off of him like a bug off of a windshield on a speeding car on a highway. That's my only encounter with him. And I've always thought of he was a bit of a clown. Mm. I love Public Image Limited. I had all their music. That was part of the same music I was listening to when I was listening to Duran Duran and Echo and the Bunnymen, you know, just totally without prejudice. All of it was coming in. But this documentary, I was watching with mouth agape. Mm. I was so interested to see that he is a deep guy. He is a very solid thinker. And I understood then that his whole clownish, gurning, show-offy act is masking a lot of pain.
Yeah, I mean, I was really astounded. I mean, this is not much of a spoiler, but, you know, everybody knows that he suffered from meningitis as a kid. But the film makes clear how much it's marked literally everything in his life. And he talks repeatedly about the terror and the fear of waking up in the morning and not knowing who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that whatever to happen to you again? It's an amazing.
Yeah, he had amnesia. I didn't actually realize that. Mm. For, what, like 4 months? He had completely lost his memory as a child. Mm. And so that made him squirrely. And everything now, or since then, was an attempt to kind of buffer himself from that kind of terror.
Yeah, and there was he talks about how when he's recovering from meningitis, his parents are saying, you know, we're your mum and dad. And he doesn't believe them at first. And he goes through his life terrified that he's going to be lied to. And he says, this shapes his behavior. I don't see the point of lying. I've been lied to. The hurt of a lie affects you for the rest of your life. And you can't, that's not what I expected from this kind of Smike meets, you know, Bill Sykes figure that he always was.
Right. Yeah, the vulnerability. I found it very touching. And this documentary I found really, really good. I don't know what you guys thought about it.
Yeah. Ralph, what did you think?
All of the same there. I'm, you know, someone who sort of has to guide artists' careers. I think the number one thing that you want is that your artists are happy and fulfilled. And this is sort of like the opposite of the Duran Duran thing, because clearly the band have made an awful lot of mistakes and there's been combustible moments which they can't come back from. He clearly is the only one who now represents the band, and that isn't great for me because I like a band to be a band. Like, I don't want to see Echo and the Bunnymen with three people who weren't in the band originally. And I read an interview with Ian McCullough a couple of weeks ago in Mojo, which basically showed him as a man who is a very solitary figure who drinks every single day from the minute he gets up, you know, because of the pain. And I think with this, there is a lot of pain there. I'm not a huge Pill fan because I didn't, you know, I definitely was more pop than Pill, but it was the vulnerability thing I wasn't expecting. I wanted to see Nora. I wanted to see what Nora had to say.
That was my favorite bit. It was so touching that he's so open and pure and loving about the effect that she's had on his life, his wife Nora.
And she's not in it.
You see pictures of this incredibly glamorous German woman who... Mm. Oh, and I love... Was it Keith Levine who said early on, like, well, you know, he asked me to be in the band. I wasn't really sure. And then I saw him with his girlfriend and I thought, well, if... You know, like,
yeah, that was great.
If this schmuck can get this woman like this, like, that gives him credibility.
Yeah.
And I had to agree.
Sean, what did you think? Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. As you say, it's very, very honest. It's about a band not getting on. And they are the Celebrity Four, aren't they? There's just such a turnover, but of really high-profile people. The stuff about John Warble just nicking. Nicking the stuff.
Just running off in tapes.
No, this isn't gloss. This isn't Duran Duran at all. This is, so you know, desperate people. People who hate each other. The thing that they had to go on tour... But they didn't want to go on tour, so they did individual dates every 4 days in America, which is really expensive. So things like that. And he couldn't call himself Johnny Rotten because Malcolm McLaren was fighting him for the copyright of that and the Sex Pistols. And the McLaren stuff, I think, is very interesting because obviously McLaren was trying to ruin anybody, you know, coming out of the Sex Pistols and trying to do anything else. And so he had to take on a different persona. That stuff, I think, is really interesting. Yeah. All that behind the scenes, how you just, again, it's how you cope after that, you know, the 2 years of being in that band, how that affects you for the rest of your life. Yeah. Meningitis aside, I thought it was a really good portrait of someone.
It is a really good portrait, and I was really surprised that you discover that the that behind that sort of that public persona of an extremely difficult interviewer and a person who will you know disrupt wherever whatever event he's in, there's actually quite a warm human being behind it.
Very warm.
There's a great little bit, the famous line of, when he delivers that, the last line of the Sex Pistols' existence, ever get the feeling you've been cheated on stage at Winterland. But in the footage, you can see he's saying it with this kind of warm, conspiratorial grin. It's not like hating on the audience. It's kind of like,
we're all in it together.
It's a big gag and we're all in on it. And the extent to which he really does care about his other band members, not so much that he's got to hang on to them forever, because when they've got to go, they've got to go. I was also really surprised when he talks about at school, the fear of sexual abuse from priests.
Yes, that was fascinating, and that shaped his persona.
And he says, you'll do anything to be perceived as ugly and useless. So the priests don't get you.
They invented punk.
Because he had to be disgusting and unfuckable, unlovable, and he turned that into a shtick.
I think it's an excellent film, and I like the fact that the Sex Pistols is done inside 12 minutes.
You also get to see his kitchen. So he's
looking at the kitchen.
Yeah. He's not sitting so many of these bloody pop stars
in a hotel room,
with nice lighting somewhere they've never been before in their life. He's in his kitchen. You can see what he's got on the counter.
Did you notice
that he was heating a cup of tea or coffee in the oven?
Weird, because that's supposed to be in a microwave. That's the American style.
In my late mother's oven. He's got the same oven as my late mother-in-law's.
These are the details that are really important.
I did love how he just totally melted and lit up when he talked about Nora, his wife.
Yeah. Also, great guests. Ad Rock, Thurston Moore, Moby, Flea, and friend of the show, Andrew Perry, are all in this show. Ginger Baker. Two seconds of the horrible Ginger Baker.
Oh, my goodness.
Poor Ginger Baker. Notoriously horrible Ginger Baker.
But I feel sorry for his body.
So essentially what we're all saying is go to that website, which is thepublicimagesrotten.com, and find out where it's showing near you, because it really... It's surprising.
I really didn't think that this was going to hold my attention, and it was great. It was gripping.
It was. Excellent. Okay, moving on. We're recording on the 4th of July, so God bless America. Let's talk about comic books. Over the past decade, Captain America has gone from a marginal character that only nerds like Ralph and me care about to a multi-million dollar blockbuster property on your kid's lunchbox and possibly your T-shirt or even your socks. The movies have made the running and the comics have found it hard to keep pace, but Marvel are now trying something new by handing this symbol of Americana over to a writer from outside the comics world. Ta-Nehisi Coates is one of the premier African-American authors, writer of The Beautiful Struggle and the Obama-era elegy We Were 8 Years in Power. He's been writing Black Panther for some months now. What will he do with Captain America? And what will non-comic book reading Katie and Sean make of it? We're going to find out after the essential collision of black culture and American patriotism. Here's the Jimi Hendrix Experience at Woodstock with the Star Spangled Banner. Oh, Say Can You See, the Jimi Hendrix Experience with the Star-Spangled Banner at Woodstock. Captain Steve Rogers would not approve. Katie, I'm going to go to you first again, because you're an actual proud American. Did Captain America mean anything to you as a kid? Did you read comics?
Yeah, I read comics, but not Captain America. So Spider-Man was one of the things I read. And I loved, later on, Love and Rockets.
Oh, yeah.
And Ghost World was something I read. I didn't read superhero comics. I wasn't familiar with Captain America, and I don't go see all those blockbuster movies. So dipping into this, the first thing that I was struck by was the beautiful, dynamic, vibrant artwork.
Yeah.
But narrative-wise, I felt like I was just leaping into the middle of the story, and it was sort of hard to care.
You are absolutely leaping into the middle of the story. Ralph, you can probably tell us where we're leaping into here.
Actually, I haven't kept up on Captain America as much as you, so it's probably better coming from you.
The gist is this. Before the story begins, there's been a bad Captain America who took over. He was in the power of Hydra, who are basically the Nazis in the Marvel comics. And he takes over America, and there's a civil war, and it's awful. But good Captain America comes back and sorts it out. And what this is about, the beginning of Ta-Nehisi Coates' run, is Captain America winning back the trust of America, getting back to being the symbol that he always was, the guy in the flag. And, to me, You know, Captain America to me as a kid, I always thought it was a bit boring because it's, you know, what relationship do I have to American patriotism? As I've grown, I've really started to love him because he is the embodiment of the debate that is America. You know, it's like, you know, what does patriotism mean? What does freedom mean? Is it freedom from things? Is it freedom to do things? Do you need, you know, to what extent should you look at your society as looking after one another? And one of the great things about Captain America is he is a junction box where you can connect all these things and you can debate what America is. And this run that Ta-Nehisi Coates is starting now with the name of Winter in America, the great Gil Scott-Heron song, is how do you fix broken America? When America's split in two, and obviously in the fictional kind of comic book world, it's split in two by villains. But in the real world, we've got actual supervillains. We've got a supervillain in the White House.
Well, see, here's the thing. When I was reading it, I was just sort of feeling a little flaccid because I just read the news every day, and I feel like much more. Well, it's a reflection of what's going on in America right now, where you have people, bad people, deplorables, as they now happily call themselves, the low information voters, who are taking these symbols of, you know, might is right and the stars and stripes and patriotism, and turning them into these horrible authoritarian, weaponized cudgels. Yeah. So I feel like I didn't learn anything new. I didn't get any insights. And maybe, you know, the next comic, I'll learn more about it. But I just feel like there's so much depressing news coming out about America right
there
now.
There is that. Ralph, as a comics person, did you enjoy it?
Not as much as I hoped I would. Mm. Obviously, at the end, they talk about the power elite and there's obviously going to be the new rise of whatever it is that they're going to create. The writing was good. For some reason, it didn't move me as much as I'd sort of hoped it would. But probably for the same reasons as you, in that I haven't kept an eye on what's been going on, so I sort of had to launch into it a bit.
This is the perennial problem with ongoing comics, which is the movies. You can jump straight in and you know exactly where you are. Comics, just sort of, even I find it hard to orientate myself sometimes when a character from 1968 pops up and you're supposed to know who they are and what their motivations are. Even a massive nerd like I find it, you know, like I am, I find it hard to keep on top of it. Sean, what did you think?
I may have to echo Katie's sentiments here and Ralph's. I felt that I was flung into a story, didn't really understand quite where I was within the story. I just found it difficult to identify with, resonate with. It is about patriotism, about freedom. It's about lots of ideals. And yet I still feel like a European reading it. Mm. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? It's very America, America, America. And I don't know where I can sort of break through that. I did like the graphics are really beautiful. They're really well drawn.
Lionel Francis Yu is a brilliant
and they're
artist. Yeah.
Fantastic fighters with the American flags etched on their face, a bit like Paul Mason picture that's going around.
These are the adversaries, because obviously every comic book needs a fight.
And that looks beautiful.
He's basically, Captain America is set up against a bunch of basically kind of
thugs. You know,
alt-right thugs with the stars and stripes tattooed on their face, who are conducting a mass shooting at the Washington Monument as some kind of nihilistic attack on American democracy.
But another problem I have with comics is when you're flung in, you're saying that you're flung in, and you have to get sort of acclimatized to it. It's the fight between good and evil. That's what kids look at, and that's good and evil. That's superheroes. Can we get into the grey? And I didn't know where the grey was here. I'm more interested in the good being evil than the evil being good, sort of.
What I quite liked about it was that I think the writing is brilliantly spare, because you're seeing all these amazing action sequences.
It's very spare. There's not masses of dialogue.
No, you're seeing these incredible action sequences, but you're getting Captain America's train of thought throughout. And as he's going through this kind of violent episode on the Mall in Washington, he's discussing that, like, it wasn't, you know, the bad guys, Hydra. They didn't conquer the people. The people conquered themselves by their own fear of one another and their own kind of mental laziness and narcissism and need for someone to blame. And I thought that was really quite powerful.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk. Ta-Nehisi Coates is obviously, you know, a writer on the progressive left. He writes a lot about, Black Lives Matter, the African-American experience. When he was given this gig to write Captain America, there was a huge explosion of complaints amongst, you know, the kind of, you know, the alt-right nerd world, who said, why are you letting this black racist write the symbol of America? Well, firstly, he's not a racist, but the idea that you can hand over this symbol of real Americana to a radical person, I think is quite
exciting. Well, I thought it was going to be more radical because
of that.
Because I'd read that and was thinking, hey. And I was surprised that it seemed quite traditional at first, but maybe it will move in a different direction.
But then is there any road in sort of having Captain America stand up and say, America is an appalling imperialist country.
Yes.
I'm taking my you know, superhero hat off.
Yeah.
I think it kind of it needs to be a little bit more kind of
You're obviously impressed by the decision that of the choice of writer, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think his Black Panther run's great. He's done really clever things with Black Panther, and he's a really dynamic writer in the sense that he can propel a story. But I do understand, particularly why Casey and Sean would be going, what the hell is going on here? Because you need an awful lot even with an entry-level, you know, restart like this, you do need quite a lot of background.
There were literally like two short paragraphs which didn't really give you enough. Mm. And I do think over the... You know what I'm obviously a big Marvel Comics fan. Over the years and growing up, even if you missed an issue, say, there would always be something in the other one which kind of would have like a little asterisk and said blah 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 blah. So you never felt like you were at sea, even if you'd missed a couple of issues. You could still get in, and that was sort of part of it. With this, I totally get it. Like that bit which was Captain America's face was taken in, but it wasn't. Like that's not really enough.
Yeah.
So I think really for you guys, it's like I don't know if that's enough to make you care, which is basically isn't it?
But I think that's the ongoing problem that comics have got, which is, you know, people understand the movies, they can get their heads around them, and the comics just too far too involved.
I mean, you've got Fantastic Four coming back. I saw in that issue there
was
an ad for it.
I was very excited to see that. Delighted. Dan Slott is writing it. He's a great writer.
And then there's a new series called Cloak and Dagger. Now Cloak and Dagger I did read growing up, but of course now they've turned it into a TV show for kids, which will probably be more successful than any version, or even if they brought out a new comic book, it's going to be the you know, my nephew would watch something on Sci-Fi or Sky over reading a comic, because that's his way in now. So I guess is that what you're saying about that's the problem?
Yeah, well, the comics have a very big problem with getting people through the door. The stories are very complicated unless you're already an adept like me, but also they're hard to buy. You've got to find a comic shop, or you've got to take the leap of going on Comixology and downloading it.
Final note on that. There was a wonderful comic shop near me in Hackney, and I used to go in and buy stuff. And as soon as Brexit got announced, the cost of importing comic books from America, they just put their hand up and went, we're going to be closed in 2 weeks. We can't make this work.
Wow.
There you go. Thanks, Nigel Farage. Another thing you've managed to fuck up for everybody. Anyway, shall we move on? I'm going to give Captain America, from the nerd point of view, from the people who know this kind of stuff, I think it's a really good restart, but I can understand why you would find it a bit tricky to get back in.
Maybe, yes. Finally, we're continuing our very loose series of tunes and reading matter for your summer holidays, all suggested by our guests. Whether you're eating carbs in Marbs or trekking to the Bowdoin pop-up in Centre Parks this year, it's not summer without proper summer music, and our guests are going to sort you out. First up, let's have a taste of Katie Puckrick's suggestions.
As I make mention of you, you're the thought wrapped in my head, you're the ink that leaves this pen as I write all about you. Stars after a setting sun. You run for the money. You don't even know about Wild Mountain Home.
Casey Puckrick's Summer Choices. That was the Mamas and the Papas with Shooting Star from People Like Us, followed by Kaja Bonet, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, with Mother Maybe from the album Child Queen, all one word. And finally, her ultimate summer tune, Steve Miller with Wild Mountain Honey. Katie, Tell us about these tunes. Let's start with this. Your classic summer album is People Like Us by the Mamas and the Papas. Tell us about it and why you love it.
Well, my mom bought me that album when it came out. I think she was trying to turn me away from the dark side. I was probably about 8 years old or so, and every time we were in a store with records, I was always drawn to Alice Cooper records with sort of satanic imagery on the cover, which alarmed her. So,
black eye makeup, like
or a snake, or something.
Yeah.
So she came home one day with People Like Us, and I mean, at the time, my record collection was a combination of Jesus Christ Superstar, Partridge Family, Sticky Fingers by Rolling Stones, and Aqualung by Jethro Tull. It's because I had older brothers and sisters, and they all influenced me. And I listened to them all with equal pleasure. And the reason why I find People Like Us such a fantastic summer album, and specifically that song Shooting Star, is because, for me, summer is very mystical and witchy and Wicker Man-ish and midsummer rituals and sensual voluptuousness. So it's not like, so all of those songs sort of share this kind of witchy mysticism. And the Shooting Star song I find so ethereal and melancholic. It's got what my friend, the writer Stephen Daly, calls ennui deluxe. So it makes you sad, but it kind of is gives you a nipple hard-on at the same time. Like you feel there's mystery involved. And I love choral singing.
I'm sure Duran Duran have an album called Ennui Deluxe, don't they? And if they don't, they should do. Make a note. Ennui Deluxe, B-side, nipple hard on. That's I found that really kind of, I mean, I would seldom reach for a Mama's Papa's record, but I found that really entrancing. And it does have, you could imagine somebody dropping that into the middle of some kind of electronic beach bar set, some kind of like 1999 Ibiza chill out thing. It would fit perfectly, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because the mood is there. We also asked you for a brand new summer album, and you chose Child Queen by Kaja Bonet. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Kaja Bonet. So she's a California artist. This is her second album. Actually, her first album was a mini album, an EP. And what I love about her approach is that it's so California. It's sunshine psychedelia. So there's the choral singing hint of the Beach Boys, but there's also that kind of early 70s psychedelia of Gloria Ann Taylor. What's Your World? I don't know if you know that artist. Mm. Linda Perhax. There's also, I don't know if you guys got this TV show called The Bugaloos over here in the early 70s. It was a kid's, I think it was the same people who did H.R. Puffin stuff. I'm blanking on the name. Anyway, never mind about that. Claudine Longet as well is somebody Kaja Bonet's style reminds me of. Françoise Hardy, the sort of 60s French poppy ingenues. So she has, she's written and produced, played everything on this album. Comes from a musical family. Is black, but you don't necessarily hear that in her music, although you have picked out a more kind of overtly soulful aspect track from the album. But the other tracks on the album are much more kind of a fog machine, mystical, very sensual.
We're back on the witchy, aren't we?
Back to witchy. I love the whole idea of sunshine psychedelia, but also I think about music that you want to play in the heat of a summer night. So I think all the songs and all the music that I selected hit that target.
Which Steve Miller's Wild Mountain Honey does as well. Is this something that's, is this the sound of your youth here?
Yes, it is. Mm. So I grew up in, I spent my coming of age years in Northern Virginia, in the suburbs of Northern Virginia outside Washington, D.C. And it was the sound of cicadas in the summer, those intense smells of the grass, of cut grass.
She's back on the smells again.
Yeah, trees, of sweat when you're getting close to a little boy for the first time, a little girl meeting a little boy. And that album, Fly Like an Eagle by Steve Miller, came out in 1976, in May 1976. So it was the sound of the summer, of the bicentennial. It was all about bomb pops and red, white, and blue imagery in America. It was just patriotism overkill. But the sensual side of 1976 was evinced by Wild Mountain Honey. And I just always think about makeout sessions in the backseat of a car. Want to hear that?
I'm sure that'll go down enormously well with our listenership, actually. I'm sure they'll want to banish those thoughts immediately. We also asked both Ralph and Katie for a beach read. And Katie, you chose Priest Daddy by Patricia Lockwood, which looks brilliant.
Oh, it's
Tell
so
the listeners.
Good. Patricia Lockwood is a poet who grew up in the American Midwest in very unusual circumstances. And Priest Daddy it's a memoir talking about all of these unusual circumstances. Her father, who was an Episcopalian minister, I think there were three children in the family by the time he made the decision that he wanted to go all the way, be hardcore, and be a Roman Catholic priest. And I grew up Roman Catholic, and I did not know that there was a loophole in this religion whereby if you're already a priest, you know, you've put in your priest flying hours, you can make the transition even though you're married and have children. And so she, that's what he did. And so Patricia Lockwood grew up in this family where they were so odd. They grew up in rectories around the Midwest. And the thing that's so astonishing about her and her writing is that she's simultaneously very specific and elegant with her words, but she's smutty, vulgar. She's got a potty mouth to beat the band, and she enjoys deploying her potty mouth to shock her father, who's ultra religious. And the thing about her priest daddy is that he is a very narcissistic, domineering, almost Donald Trump, self-absorbed type character. And she fights him all the way with her waywardness, with her mouth. But there's great images in the her account of him shredding on the guitar upstairs. Like, he gets home from church, throws his cassock off, and he's naked. He goes around the house. He's basically in his underpants, but there's a lot of nudity, and he gets out his guitar and he shreds.
And he's a gun nut as well.
He's a bit of a gun nut, and she talks about she actually writes the book while she comes back to live at home as an adult with her husband, who's having a health crisis. He's having problems with his vision, and he loses his job as a journalist, so they have to move back to the family home. And that's when, as an adult, she's looking back at the family with fresh eyes going, whoa, this is a book. This is a story. And she actually writes the book to get themselves out of the hole so that they can move out of the house and start their lives again.
Finish the book so we can go home.
Yes.
Well, if you are a Catholic or you're married to one like me, I'm sure this is going to hit the spot enormously. That's Priest Daddy by Patricia Lockwood. Let's have a listen to some of Ralph Moore's choices.
Like a wedding band, Wonderland, so my alias is Alice.
More summer stuff. That was New Eureka Soul with Black Gold of the Sun from Ralph's classic summer album, New Eureka Soul. Then Janelle Monáe with Django Jane from his new summer album, Dirty Computer. And finally, Ralph's choice for the ultimate summer tune of all time, the Beach Boys with Kokomo. Right, Ralph, New Eureka Soul. For those that don't know, explain this record.
Well, I guess the first thing you should say is that it came out on Talking Loud Records, so Giles Peterson was the A&R, and it was very much in the era of physical music. So the box set of the time, you know, it was this wonderful, massive, beautiful piece of art, that I'm pretty sure was made of wood. I think it cost about £100 at the time, even 20 years ago. And then, of course, there was the vinyl, which looked amazing. And then once you got through the artwork and the vinyl, the music was probably... well, it was made by Masters at Work, so it's Little Louis Vega and Kenny Dope. And they literally called up everyone from Tito Puente to Roy Ayres and got them all to make a brand new tribute to the music that they loved growing up. And then all the remixes that came in, whether that was Ronnie Size or Amar Van Helden, contemporised it for clubs. So it's a perfect summer record. The singles were all amazing. It's All Right, I Feel It with Jocelyn Brown. It wasn't trying too hard to be something. It was obviously nostalgic, but it also felt very much of the time and of everything that sort of came out on Talking Loud, whether that was Young Disciples or, I mean, God, there were loads, weren't there?
Ronnie Size
later on. But yeah, he did one of the remixes. It very much summed up that late 90s time, and it still stands up today. There's no question. Like, all those, like, you're never going to go a summer and not hear Black Gold of the Sun somewhere. And
who did the original Black Gold of the Sun?
That's a good question.
Rotary Connection.
That's it. Yeah. Merp. Puckrick. Rotary Connection. Points to
Minnie Riperton.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm. It's one of those songs that you sort of, you kind of know what you don't know. It's you've always heard it in the background, and you know that it's, you know, you've heard multiple versions of it, and then when it kind of comes into focus, you kind of go, oh right, yes, I've always known this song.
Yeah.
Without really kind of being conscious about it.
And often I really, you know, as an A&R, you can I hate forced A&R, so I hate half the records that are what I call mathematical equations in the top 10 now, where it's like Tiësto featuring X plus Y equals hit. Mm. And it's not even just about Tiësto. They're like, in hip hop and pop at the moment, it's a mathematical equation to have a hit. And so it will be the rapper of the moment who won't be around in 6 months' time doing something. Yeah. So it's not based on reverence or admiration. It's based on a chart or some algorithms that have made that thing happen. So
yeah.
this was made from the heart, and if you had to sort of condense dance music down to 50 all-time albums, this would have to be on there in some way, shape or form. It's a classic.
Yeah. And your summer record, your brand new summer record rather, is Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer, which you've talked about on the show before.
I think this is the best artist album of the year for me. I think she's a complete one-off. Interestingly, there's Brian Wilson features on this album. He's on backing vocals. And it's little touches like that. And the fact that she nods to Prince but doesn't over... you can sort of smell and sense his sort of spirit, but he's not referenced or... Like, she said he worked on the record, but we don't know to what degree. Mm-hmm. So that adds a sort of bit of mystery. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. And I think she's doing... The record stands up to repeated listens, which is what an album should do. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of many albums this year that I've kept listening to. I mean, how many new albums do you keep listening to after, like, 2 or 3 weeks now? Yeah. I mean, it's almost, there's just too many choices. Like, I love Beyonce. I love a bit of Jay-Z. I've already stopped listening to the new Carter's record, and it came out 2 weeks ago. Right. Whereas this, I'll go back to.
Yeah.
And your choice of the ultimate summer record is kind of, it's quite canon, this, isn't it, Ralph Kokomo?
I mean, yeah. How do you pronounce it, Andrew?
Kokomo, Ralph. It's Kokomo.
I read Brian Wilson's latest autobiography on a plane recently. Pop fact: Kokomo's not a real place. Didn't know that.
Oh,
it was a made up word, not idea. It's an idea of a place.
So it sort of doesn't matter how you pronounce it, is what you're saying? Because it's a made up word.
You can take a lady to it, and she won't really notice. It could be really rubbish.
I mean, all the other places I'm pretty sure are real places, but when Kokomo is not. Also, we are in this interesting time now where it's 30 years since 1988. So this is from the film Cocktail, which came out in 1988, which is also like Big, which came out in 1988. And whether you're a film fan or a fan of the 80s or not, there were some good films in 88, as there are every year. But it's very much tied to Cocktail, and most people like a bit of Cocktail, even if they don't like Tom Cruise.
But also the music that we were listening to in 1988 and the style of Cocktail and Big are quite far apart, aren't they? And yet they're part of one big mental thing. It's what you're doing in a really amazing summer when you're having a really amazing time.
The final thing on this record is the thing that a lot of the acts that you do like, Andrew, can't do 20 years after having not had a hit. This was a hit.
Yeah.
This was a hit for the Beach Boys, who before and since have never had a hit. So essentially they can sit there as a band of the 60s and said, in 1988, we had a global smash, just like Duran Duran said, in 1993, we had one of the biggest records of the year. And that is the thrill of a band with a lifetime in pop. Mm. Brian Wilson doesn't have much to do with this record at all, but it doesn't really matter because it's still a great record whether he's on it or not. It's Beach Boys canon. I imagine half the band don't even like it, but it doesn't matter.
Is it mainly a Mike Love record? Is that the dirty secret? Mike Love, who everybody hates.
It probably is, isn't it?
I thought it was I went back and listened to it. And I listened to it and I'm surprised actually how amazing it is. It is a, you know, you think, but you're right. It's great.
And your Beach Read, the book you've chosen, is...
I'm going down the Duran route again, aren't I? I've got Room to Dream by David Lynch and Christine McKenna. It's literally just arrived. If you're a fan of David Lynch, though, it's part memoir, part biography, and it's people that he knows and has collaborated with coming up with ideas.
How many pages? It looks like a really big book. You have to be on a very long
holiday.
Horse choker.
It's 540.
But look, big font. Yeah, lots of white space.
Big font, good for a beach book because you can read it with your sunglasses on.
500 pages or so?
It's 500 pages. Okay. It's got great pictures. Yeah. And
he's got great
hair. Not a straight biography. It's people, like I said, people that he's talked to. I mean, you open any page and it's like, you know, 194, he's talking about Dune. Go back, he's talking about Eraserhead. Like, if you love David Lynch, and everyone likes a bit of David Lynch, I think. Mm.
Not so much. I think, as Andrew says, he's got great hair and that has propelled him forward.
Well, I was just looking there.
If he was bald, he would have that kind of
fortuitously, the book opened, as Ralph was waving it around there, on young David Lynch, when he had amazing hair in the style of, he looked like Ian Wright out of the Human League. Really good hair, you know.
Look at that.
So
he does look like a member of the Human League.
That's great hair.
Phil Oakey there.
Yeah. So that's two bits of great hair. Most of us can't pull off one bit of great hair in our life. He's pulled off two separate great bits of hair. I said most of us, not all of us, Sean. You and Casey obviously have amazing hair. Yeah. Ralph's is pretty good. I'm not even going there. But, you know, that's two great bits of hair and a good read as well, by the look of it.
I did interview him a couple of years ago and it was great. I spent the whole interview thinking, am I actually on the phone to David Lynch? But it was good. And at the end, the bit I will always remember, he said, thank you very much. Take care, Ralph. And I thought, my God, you remembered my name. Yeah. And of course, the interview was great because he had an album out on Sunday Best, which is obviously upstairs selling the records.
And we're in the Soho Radio Studios at the moment. There's a pop-up shop upstairs
at
Soho
Radio.
And
that's why I got to interview him. But he was, you know, he does love music. He's definitely an auteur. And I guess this sort of reminds me of the bit when I came in last and we were talking about Talking Heads and David Byrne and the great hair, which leads everything.
The same great hair.
It's just about the hair for you, isn't it, Ralph?
It's not about the hair, but he is. I think David Lynch has earned his place in popular culture for sure.
Which is probably a good point to end the show at, because we're kind of running to the end of it. Thank you to our special guest, Casey Puckrick. What are you up to next, Casey?
Oh, well, this is a really good thing to be doing right in the middle of our beautifully warm summer, unseasonably warm. I'm working on a documentary about an Inuit building an igloo.
Good time to be doing that.
Yes.
Who are you working on that for?
It's going to be for BBC Four.
Fantastic. Really? Casey Puckrick's Ice Baby or something like that. Or, you know, Grand Igloo Design.
It's actually for their ongoing strand of slow TV.
Oh,
so
right,
very
yeah.
meditative, in the moment. It's going to have this interesting sound design element, ASMR, audio sensory meridian response.
Yeah.
So it's very sound forward, very kind of give you that back of the neck tingle feeling to as they slice into the ice, as they crunch onto the snow.
So like that Lapland when they did the reindeer journey,
correct,
or whatever it was, which was fantastic.
Like that kind of
absolutely
thing.
I loved it at Christmas.
So listen out for Casey Puckrick's ambient igloo. Come
watch
and see
out him. For it.
Yes, watch out. Absolutely. And Ralph, thanks for coming in. What are you up to next?
More Ibiza, no doubt. Definitely more Ibiza. I'm going to Deckmantle for the first time this year to see a couple of DJs, Palms Tracks and Special Request. So that's in Amsterdam. And then... Gosh, what else? You know, keeping an eye on all things Mixmag as well. Lots and lots of great shows. Going to go see The Cure on Saturday again. I saw them at Meltdown a couple of weeks ago. And then Saturday they're playing Hyde Park for the 40th anniversary. Can't miss that.
Good heavens. Okay, well, tease up your hair. Thanks both for coming in. Please come back whenever you like. Thanks, of course, to Sean Pattenden and to producer Sophie Black, who's twiddling the knobs. Don't forget, dear listener, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/channels/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. We're going to be taking a week off next week because we're lazy and it's summer. So we're going to see you on Saturday, the 21st of July, for more Big Mouth. Have fun, and don't forget the Factor 50.